This afternoon, I would like to reflect on collectedness and wisdom. And I will pick up from the hindrances that River mentioned and then go through some of the same territory that Katrin mentioned yesterday afternoon, perhaps in a slightly different way, and then take it a little bit further from there. Especially as we are now in the last full day of our retreat. And there will be lots of water imagery and similes. I almost made this into a talk about water. And I'll begin by describing the similes that I use for the hindrances that relate to water. So craving is compared to water that is colored. Aversion or ill will is compared to water that is boiling. That lack of energy and vitality and sensitivity, translated in this old-fashioned sloth and torpor, is compared to water that is full of moss and seaweed. Restlessness and anxiety is compared to water that is ruffled by the wind. And doubt is compared to muddy water in the dark. And what they all have in common is that if one were to approach water of these characteristics in order to see their own reflection, they would get a distorted image. The water would be colored, or it would be boiling, or it's covered with moss, or it's ruffled by the wind, or it's dark and muddy. It speaks to this idea that the hindrances do not help clarity as well as tranquility. And we can see sometimes when we are completely overwhelmed by reactive patterns, we may kind of lose who we are or who we want or can be. We can't see our own reflection. We can't see clearly. There is a passage that's repeated in many, many of the ancient Buddhist texts of the Pali Canon that I really like, and it says, when a meditator sees that the five hindrances are absent in themselves, appreciation is born. Being appreciative, joy arises. When the mind is joyful, the body calms down. When the body calms down, one feels at ease. And being at ease, the mind becomes collected. This word collectedness is what is usually translated as concentration. It's the Pali word samadhi, S-A-M-A-D-H-I, also known in the yoga traditions. Samadhi. How many people know this word? How many people are familiar with this word? Just to get a sense of, okay. Usually translated concentration, I'm not a big fan, I'll explain why. But if we look at this passage, that as I say is repeated in many, many texts, there isn't much emphasis on attention or focusing. It does not say that the mind becomes collected or concentrated through focusing very intently and effortfully at one particular point. It doesn't say that. It says that it all starts when one realizes that the hindrances are absent. And it includes joy and tranquility and being at ease. It's a very organic process. It does not emphasize focusing or effort. It's rather than through our being mindful of what's present and absent in our experience, we get a more balanced view instead of focusing just on what is difficult. And we see how the mind changes. And over time, that starts to mature into more collectedness. So I would say that we deepen collectedness, we deepen samadhi with the pacification of our reactive and compulsive habits through mindful observation. Also, the end of that passage says that when one feels at ease, the mind becomes collected. And what's quite interesting about this formulation is that it doesn't say that you concentrate. You don't concentrate, you don't make the mind concentrated. The mind becomes collected. In the original, it's in the passive voice. The verb is, you know, this is a process that happens to the mind, in the mind. So that's why I really like this phrase, that we allow the mind to settle. We don't make it settle. It's not going to work. Have you ever tried to say to someone, be still, be very still, come on, calm down? And if it doesn't work, then you start to put in even more kind of force there. Really be still. It backfires. We allow the mind to settle. And of course we do this through an anchor, through having a particular point that we return to, and that is about attention. We could even say focus. But it's also through letting things be, through seeing all those patterns play out and just allowing them to be there and fall away of their own accord. Through disengaging from them, which doesn't mean not being in contact with them, but to not get involved in the usual particular ways that we do. But just allowing them to be there, allowing them to pass away. Perhaps we could say unhooking from our addiction to these patterns. And in this way we gain an alternative way of being. We gain the skill of unhooking, which we can then use in our daily life, to get an alternative perspective on how we can relate to our experience. An image I found quite recently in these early texts is that of a river which is full of small channels that lead the water away from it to irrigate fields. And it said this is like being full of the hindrances. Whether the practice is to start closing those channels. And this, for me, evokes this sense of direction, of coherence, of not dissipating our energy in these endless patterns that just feed themselves over and over, but to direct our energies. And then in that sense, we can speak also of the cushion of alive with focus. A life that's integrated, that's consistent, coherent, that has a certain integrity and direction. And I think that the word concentration doesn't capture these connotations very well. And collectedness, being collected or gathered, does it a bit better. When I think of concentration, the word concentration, the first thing that comes to mind is someone studying very hard, kind of elbows on the desk and kind of trying to get information, a lot of information through a very narrow channel to one's small brain and cramming in as much as possible. It's an image full of tension. Concentration just has this connotation of lots of things crammed into one small space. Or if you think of, you know how Coke is 90% water and 10% something that we probably would not like to drink on its own. or if you think of orange juice concentrate or laundry detergent that's concentrate, all these are ways of actually getting the water out of something and then just concentrating all that intensity somewhere. And of course, water being an image of life, when we take the water out of something, we take the life out of that thing, that which allows it movement and flow. And there's in fact quite a lot of images of samadhi, of collectedness, in the Pali Canon that use water. If you're familiar with the images that are given for the jhanas, these states of collectedness, some of them speak about being completely immersed in water. So rather than concentration, I find it more helpful to think in terms of a certain continuity of attention, a certain constancy, also being centered and gathered, collected. Where yes, we are not scattered. So if we think of a herd, it's, you know, gathered, collected, but there's no need to be kind of pushed into a small space or cramped. There's still spaciousness. One of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, explains samadhi as stability of mind. And I quite like this, stability of mind. And you may have experienced moments of this during the retreat, or even as a sort of unshakiness that gradually starts to underlie your day. And in some moments, it might be more present and other moments less, but there's a certain stability that starts to build. A bit returning to the image of the boat, as if the boat is in the sea and the sea is quite calm. And even when the waters are still, they aren't not completely kind of unmoving. Stillness is not immobility. So that image of the boat floating in the still water, but there's always some movement. But at the same time, a balance of the boat. So there's certainly this attentional aspect of collectedness, of samadhi. But it's not the only one. And I think sometimes we really, really zoom into this aspect of collectedness, as it's all about attention and being very attentive. It's quite interesting to notice how the Buddhist traditions have not generally explained our ordinary condition as one of extreme distraction, and nirvana is not a state of hyper attention. Might be one element of it, of course, scatteredness, dispersion, or being focused, but this is not the main thing, perhaps. The Buddhist traditions tend to speak rather an ethical language. And this, to me, is the second aspect of collectedness, the first one being attention, and the second one being this ethical aspect. The hindrances are that which overwhelm awareness and weaken discernment. They weaken our wisdom. It's not just that they make us distracted, which they do, but also they overwhelm awareness and weaken our capacity to discern. As I think Catherine said yesterday, what is for our own benefit and for the benefit of others? They cloud our judgment. So collectedness is sometimes called, it's a skillful state, or sometimes it's called a wholesome state. As that passage, it begins with the hindrances being absent. So it's a state where there is no overwhelm of craving or hostility or anxiety or insensitivity or confusion, all those compulsive habit patterns. I think it's also useful to think of this in terms of degree, that it's not that they're either super present or completely absent, but a particular hindrance can be more or less present. It's like the volume can be up or down. So we can think in terms of degrees. Oh, this is a bit quieter now. There is maybe some aversion, but it's quieter. Or there may be temporal freedom from those hindrances, moments where they are absent or very, very, very quiet. And that is a type of liberation in that moment. It's a type of freedom. So there is a collectedness of formal practice, but I find it really useful to think also of a daily life collectedness. A certain stability of mind that infuses our daily life. And the aim to cultivate these moments more and more frequently in our life that are free from the hindrances, even if temporarily, even if by a certain degree free from the hindrances, to some extent. And of course there is a connection between these attentional and ethical aspects of collectedness. Because these compulsive reactive patterns are what scatter us, are what drive our attention from one place to the other. And they churn our thinking and they create a lot of internal chatter. And I don't know if you have observed how different mind states have different effects on how your body feels, on, of course, your mood, but also different mind states create more or less discursiveness, more or less circular thinking. It's not like any mind state will have the same degree of internal chatter or the same volume of internal chatter. And these are some of the things that we begin to see in retreats like this. Oh, there's a difference. Oh, this one is quieter. Oh, this one feels more spacious. This one feels constrained. So some agitate more or less. Some create more chatter or less. And in pacifying that reactivity, more naturally the mind becomes settled and collected. And I use the word pacifying very, very consciously. So I really like the word pacifying, pacification. It's when you resolve a conflict, when you bring peace to something. And you may know this word samatha, samatha and vipassana, usually explained as the two main qualities of meditation, the calm and the insight. Or sometimes even thought of as two different types of meditation. And literally, samatha means resolution. It's the resolution of a conflict. So in the Vinaya literature, what I mentioned the other day, that regulates the life of Buddhist monastics, there are lots of stories of conflicts, and when they get resolved, that is called samatha. Something is resolved. And there's always a conflict in the hindrances, right? With some obsessive thinking or thinking full of hostility, there's always some sort of conflict, and that can be pacified. Not through force of will. I think this idea of pacification already brings in tenderness and patience and friendliness, metta. So from these two aspects, the attentional and the ethical, we can see how collectedness supports wisdom, seeing clearly. On the one hand, this continuity of attention, this stability of mind, this lower degree of shakiness allows us to see more fully things from different angles. This continuity allows for a bigger picture, a more complete picture, less partial, less episodic. And that allows us to see impermanence and change, as it was mentioned yesterday. We can see how things arise and linger and then pass away, which we would miss if we would just kind of look quickly here and then look there and we were all over the place. And when there is some collectedness, we can see that coming and going more naturally, more easily. The Thai teacher Ajahn Chah had this expression that it's like seeing still flowing water. Still flowing water. This kind of paradox in this image. It's still and flowing. And this really suggests to me, experientially, that sense of being in a relatively collected, composed, calm state while seeing all the fluidity of our experience. Still flowing water. On the other hand, this freedom from the hindrances, even if it's temporarily, even if it's partial, also allows us to see things from a less self-centered viewpoint. Usually the hindrances are quite self-centered states. They're quite self-referential, maybe some more than others. But there is a lot of self-centeredness, a lot of circular reasoning and thinking about me and myself and what I am and what I will be and what I was and what I have, and it's usually all about me. I don't know if you have noticed, I don't want to assume. But I notice this. A lot of it is about me. But when these hindrances are more quiet, then we have more space to see things from a non-self-centered perspective. We see more things, we see more clearly, as in that image of the water. We can see ourselves reflected, we can see more clearly if the water is still while flowing. We can see what is difficult in a different way. We can see dukkha, that pain and dissatisfaction, perhaps in places where we don't really want to see it. And it may strike us sometimes quite clearly how a certain pattern of ours that has been playing out and we have been observing during a retreat is painful. And why do I do this all the time? Does it serve anything? It's actually quite unpleasant. But I have things invested in it. I have a sense of, well, this is who I am, this is how I do things, this is my personality. So I'm going to hold on to this and suffer. They're not willing to really see, oh, this is actually detrimental to my quality of life and to my capacities to be available for others. It's not helping. So we see our vulnerability as well. We see what may be difficult to see, but because of our increased capacity to be with experience as it is, whatever it is, we can see these things more vividly. And we also see the vulnerability and humanity of others who are just like ourselves. Their own patterns that may be painful for them. And if our patterns are conditioned, and they're conditioned by our histories, and by our culture, and by our language, and by our human biology, so are the patterns of others, equally conditioned. They are the children or circumstances that are beyond their conscious decision. And that, again, allows to see shared humanity, to see connection, and to have compassion as well. We can see the connection between things in a state of collectedness, as we're seeing a fuller, kind of bigger picture. Our feelings, our thoughts, the way our body feels, and especially we see a bit more clearly that the way that we relate to experience affects the experience. And we start to see, oh, when I meet this in this particular way, this happens. When I meet it in a different way, that happens. And I just start to see this. So, seeing conditionality can in itself be quite a freeing experience. Because if things are conditioned, if they are circumstantial, it means that they can change, that there can be freedom, liberation, transformation, that they are not stuck. And this is good news. We are not stuck with what we think or feel at one particular moment that we are. And this brings me to the third aspect of collectedness. We've had the attentional, the ethical, and this third one that I'm going to call flexibility or malleability. And for this I'm going to read a passage from one of these texts from the Pali Canon. It says this: a goldsmith or their apprentice places gold dust in a crucible, and they blow on it, melt it, and purify it. While the gold is not settled and without dross, it's not soft, malleable, and radiant, but brittle. It's not ready to be worked. But there comes a time when, as the goldsmith or their apprentice continues to blow on it, melt it, and purify it, the gold becomes soft, malleable, and radiant, not brittle. It's ready to be worked. Then, whatever ornament they wish, they can create. A belt, a necklace, an earring, a golden garland. In the same way, for someone devoted to developing the mind and heart, collectedness may not be peaceful, refined, tranquil, and unified, but hindered by one's own patterns. I don't know if it sounds familiar. It sounds familiar to me. But there comes a time when their mind becomes pleased and settled internally, unified, collected. Such a collectedness is peaceful, refined, tranquil, unified, unhindered by one's own patterns. Then, whatever deeper understanding they set their minds to, they can realize it. There are similar passages that are more explicit in applying those qualities of the gold to the mind. So the mind becomes soft and malleable and workable. Radiant. And you may have tasted this state of a mind that's more pliable, malleable. Quite different from states that we also are quite familiar with, of a mind that's rigid and inflexible, not adaptable, not responsive, but set in very particular and narrow ways. And usually when that happens, it's interesting to look for one of the hindrances. I think they contribute to this rigidity. Whereas we try to cultivate, and the practice helps us cultivate, this flexibility, adaptability, malleability, that allows us to fashion the mind into different things as it's needed for the situation. So we can show up somewhere and go, what is the situation here? What is happening? What's needed? How can I help? Beyond the plans I had of how things were supposed to go, beyond my script, beyond my predictions. What is actually the situation and how can I engage with it? There was a paper not too long ago about the effects of mindfulness practice, and they described it in these terms: cognitive, emotional, and behavioral flexibility. And I think this is basically what that text is talking about. It's cognitive, emotional, and behavioral flexibility. And if I just take the cognitive flexibility, I think this is quite an important one. To be able to see from different points of view. I have this memory from when I was, 8, 9, or maybe 10, something like this, in primary school. And I remember we were sitting in the classroom, and we used to sit in tables of four, as in the dining room, rather than all of us facing the blackboard. And I had this moment when I realized that if there was one of my classmates at the other side who I could see their face, that meant that they saw the classroom from that particular angle. And that if I saw John's face, they saw John's back of the neck. And if I saw Laura's neck, they saw Laura's face because of how we're seated. And I remember feeling, what a revelation. And so it's the first time, at least, that I consciously remember understanding what a point of view was. And that was a visual insight. It was about how we saw things just in terms of, oh, if I see their face, I see their back. Weird. But it becomes, for me, kind of a memory of this waking up to perspective and realizing that perspective is the privilege of space. It is because there is space that a viewpoint, that a particular point of view, can move and see something from a different angle. If there was no space, that would be impossible to do. If there is no space between you and an object, you can only see that particular thing. You need space in order to see it more fully. And one thing that a lot of the hindrances and the reactive patterns do is they suck the space out. And we can't move our point of view. So the text actually continues for a little more after it has said that once one has that collectedness, then whatever deeper understanding they set their minds to, they can realize it. It says, if they wish, they can experience the superpowers. Being one, I may become many. Being many, I may become one. I may know greedy mind as greedy, aversive mind as aversive, confused mind as confused. I may know contracted mind as contracted, composed mind as composed, limited mind as limited, and boundless mind as boundless. I think the second one about knowing greedy mind as greedy, etc., speaks about this increased ability to see how we are relating to something, to see our filters. Not what I am experiencing or what am I seeing, but how am I seeing it? Colored by what? Is the water colored? Is the water boiling? Etc. So we gain sensitivity to how we are seeing something. Perhaps we could say that we usually just see the thing seen. And with the practice, we learn to see the seeing itself. We learn to see the activity of seeing and how is it happening and from what vantage point and what filters are there. And when we know where something is coming from, when we know what is conditioning our minds at that moment, then we gain choice and freedom. Freedom to act from intention and value rather than impulse or habit. Have this freedom to act more from our commitment to certain values. And the first one I really like is, being one, I may become many. Being many, I may become one. If I listen to this kind of with an imaginative mind, I find it quite inspiring. I find it sort of artistic. I don't know. Being one, I become many. I think it speaks to the creativity to be who we want to be or who we need to be in a particular situation, rather than stay fixed in a very small cell of who we think we are, of a fixed personality. We can be many people at many different times. Actually, we already are. I don't know if you've noticed these days that sometimes you are the great meditator, sometimes you are the hopeless meditator, and sometimes you are very irritable and sometimes quite composed and peaceful. Being one, we become many. At the same time, being many, we become one, because all that is part of this coherent who we are. I also think it's a particularly queer image, that being one we become many, and being many we become one. And how we can go beyond norms and boundaries. And it is an image of fluidity for me. We can be who we want to be and who we need to be. I think a lot of those patterns, a lot of those hindrances are a bit of self-sabotage in that regard. But we can be uncluttered by them, unhindered by one's own patterns, as the text says. And then we can fashion whatever ornament we want, and we can be a necklace, and we can be an earring, and we can be a belt or a golden garland. So I'd like to end by just reading that passage again. A goldsmith or their apprentice places gold dust in a crucible, and they blow on it, melt it, and purify it. While the gold is not settled and without dross, it's not soft, malleable, and radiant, but brittle. It's not ready to be worked. But there comes a time when, as the goldsmith or their apprentice continues to blow on it, melt it, and purify it, the gold becomes soft, malleable, and radiant, not brittle. It's ready to be worked. Then, whatever ornament they wish, they can create. A belt, an earring, a necklace, a golden garland. In the same way, for someone devoted to developing the mind and heart, collectedness may not be peaceful, refined, tranquil, and unified, but hindered by one's own patterns. But there comes a time when their mind becomes pleased and settled internally, unified, collected. Such a collectedness is peaceful, refined, tranquil, and unified, unhindered by one's own patterns. Then, whatever deeper understanding they set their minds to, they can realize it. If they wish, they can experience the superpowers. Being one, I may become many. Being many, I may become one. I may know greedy mind as greedy, aversive mind as aversive, confused mind as confused. I may know contracted mind as contracted, composed mind as composed, limited mind as limited, and boundless mind as boundless. So this is what I wanted to share this afternoon. Thank you very much for your attention, and we can sit quietly until the bell rings.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.